Hello and welcome to Is This Anime? I am your quote-unquote anime expert, Jack Metcalf, and joining us is a brand new guest, Arthur Bianchini. Arthur, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, sir?
Fantastic, man. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for reaching out. Dear listener, Arthur, I didn't know Arthur before. Arthur just reached out because he had listened to the podcast before. And guess what, folks? My DMs are open, as always. The socials are there. So if you ever just want to blindly reach out and come on the podcast, Arthur is a perfect example of a cool person who reached out. And now we're already cooking and covering one of Arthur's favorites. So let's get right into it. We are covering Saint Seiya. So Arthur, why Saint Seiya? Why did you want to cover this?
Well, long story short, Jack, you kind of shut me down on the one that I wanted to cover, but that's besides the point here. Saint Seiya is nostalgic to me. I watched it when I was 10. I was watching in Brazil back in 1993. I'm originally from Brazil, so it was a big hit in Latin America. So it's kind of the first one that I got introduced to. It was before I started watching that, and then I started watching Yu Hakusho after that, and then it was my shonen kickoff. So it was kind of the first one that I actually seen.
Yeah, absolutely. And you did say you wanted to cover the live action Yu Yu Hakusho. I did mildly shut it down because, just quite frankly, because this might even be an early discussion of that, I enjoyed the live action Yu Yu Hakusho. I guess for me, it's just a question of how much can we even discuss about it? Because we've already covered it before. We already covered the movies. That was kind of my fun take of covering the anime. But yeah, I just felt that the show, it was good, and I enjoyed the 5 episodes that it was, but there just wasn't enough to it. I'm like, what would I even talk about on this podcast?
Well, I think, I didn't mean to interrupt, but the thing with the live action, there is stuff to talk about. But yeah, I do agree with you in a matter of that the show is it just a very slim version of the Dark Tournament. I think the best part of the anime got cut out, which to me is a Dark Tournament and eventually Chapter Black, but at the same time, it's kind of they condense too much of the cool fights from, the show and the character development. But it's a different story for another time. This is not the Yu Yu Hakusho right now. So
I know. Well, this is me giving you the luxury of getting to discuss it now. I'm just okay, here's your gimme. But yeah, fair enough. Maybe we'll cover it for season 2 if that ever comes out. I don't know. Because that was my issue. It just felt too slimmed down. It felt like they didn't have enough confidence they would get renewed. I'm because the show was successful. Yu Yu Hakusho did really well. And I think maybe if they knew it was going to do better than they thought it would, they would have taken their time more. Because they're we don't have to rush the first big arc because we're going to have more seasons.
Right. I think the problem too is that what I noticed that, there's good things about the show that I liked. It's just, I think the fact that, the four saying beasts got cut out and that they incorporated the bugs and stuff like that. So that's part of it too.
Yeah.
And then the dark, and don't get me wrong, some of the characters were amazing. Some of the actors that played the characters, the guy that played Toguro was brilliant, and then Turokune and all those guys. I know I have a very fond memory of Yu Hakusho. That's kind of why I brought it up, but
for sure,
it's not the one that we're talking about today, so it's fine.
Yeah, fair. But we were talking about Saint Seiya because when you brought up Saint Seiya, I was this is a show I've really wanted to cover, but I myself did not have the knowledge or quote unquote love for it that I felt I could cover it sufficiently. So when you were like, oh yeah, I'm a pretty big Saint Seiya fan, I'm like, yeah, sure. Why don't you pick the 5 episodes we cover? And we've done this before on the podcast enough times where it's not just me picking it. But, before we drop right into it, I think the 5 you picked were actually pretty darn good because I had told you before, I'm like, yeah, I've watched 80 episodes, but I barely fucking remember it. And there's reasons why. I can see, I think the episodes you've picked, which are 1, 6, 14, 71, and 72, those are actually a really strong showcase. So good for you, man. You aced this assignment.
Well, And sorry to interrupt, but like the thing is with the show itself, it shows how like, you know, there's character development and all this stuff. And then I think, and then we'll touch on it, like when we talk about like episode one especially, it's like how I like, and I think you probably will agree with me, I think the way they did the female characters on the show for a 80s show is pretty good. They're not weak characters. They will beat the shit out of you.
Yeah, absolutely. You're kind of jumping ahead, but for sure, we're on the same level. Anyways, because we're clearly already want to talk about the show, let's just get into the history segment. So Saint Seiya, it was created by Masami Kurumada. Kurumada got his start as a professional manga author in 1974 with the school life shonen manga Sukeban Arashi. It's about two girls in a rivalry that eventually involves their entire school. It ran for like 15 chapters. You could find it for free on the various pirate sites. And his follow-up was actually, I can't believe I've never heard of this series because it turns out it's possibly even more influential than Saint Seiya, given what it established. It's a boxing series called Ring ni Kakero, which ran for 25 volumes. It ran for about 5 years. And it was also adapted into an anime, although it took until 2004 for that to finally happen. And it turns out, like, Ring ni Kakero, that was, like, one of, if not the first anime to establish, like, characters charging using, like, ki or some form of power concept like that. The other cool thing, have you heard of Ring ni Kakero?
No, I haven't. I know he did. I know he did a also a. I think it was a soccer manga. I'm not exactly sure. I'm probably saying something wrong because there's one that's kind of like you have like the same hairstyles as Saint Seiya because that's like an 80s trope hairstyle kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm actually just about to get into why these character designs are so similar, because that's another cool concept I can't believe we haven't touched on the podcast. So, Kurumada, like many of his generation, he was heavily inspired by the godfather of manga, Osamu Tezuka, and one of Tezuka's signature techniques was his so-called star system, which involved reusing character designs, personalities, and even their names. So that's cool. I've read a biography of Tezuka, but I completely forgot about this concept. Because yeah, a lot of Tezuka series have the same character designs. Likewise, like Astro Boy, among them for sure. So yeah, this was considered a fun way of treating manga characters like Hollywood actors, and also a convenient way of sparing the author of having to come up with new designs in each series. So that's why Kurumada has very similar leads and other supporting characters within his manga, and why they all look a certain way. It's because of the star system. So the lead of Ring ni Kakero, Takane Ryuji, he would be the design for almost all of Kurumada's manga works going forward, including Saint Seiya. Maybe we have to cover Ring ni Kakero at some point because, yeah, this is a highly influential series that I didn't even know about. Yeah, you were saying soccer manga. Yeah, Kurumada is very prolific. I'm only talking about these top three series, but we would be here all day if we talked about his other works. He is not a guy who just made Saint Seiya and then chilled. He's done a lot of stuff.
I think like it's kind of like those authors that's like the same thing with like I would say like Togashi that did like you know mainly the two ones that we everybody's fond of, you know, the Hunter x Hunter and Yu Hakusho. So it's kind of like it's like you kind of can see some influences from that too. And then also like we were talking in our messages that he is the, you know, he's the pre Dragon Ball Z, you know, fantasy world kind of thing, and the power ups and all this stuff. So it's kind of like interesting how some of the inspirations from Dragon Ball was kind of taken from Sensei, like the, you know, your the cloth being the you know, later on in the series you will find out more,
Yeah.
but it's kind of like when they power up and then they got the gold cloth and all this stuff when they are like lower rank as being a bronze cloth. So
So I actually have to correct myself because I got, it turns out Dragon Ball actually, Dragon Ball OG or just Dragon Ball, because I know Dragon Ball the manga is just called Fire Dragon Ball. Dragon Ball does predate Saint Seiya by about a year. But what's interesting is I found a translated letter from Toriyama that's on like YouTube. And it turns out Toriyama was a huge fan of Ring ni Kakero and Kurumada's other series. And he even like wrote a letter to Shonen Jump telling them how much he admired Kurumada. So again, man, we thought we were doing the Saint Seiya podcast. We're doing like the warm-up for Ring ni Kakero, because it turns out Toriyama loved this before he did Dragon Ball, which is awesome. So yeah, Kurumada himself said he wasn't even particularly interested in Greek mythology. He just needed an extra hook when his original idea for a karate series inspired by the Karate Kid movie wasn't enough for his publisher. He said Greek mythology had a lot of cool characters and grace to it, so that was enough for him. Again, we love Toriyama. We love all our manga authors who are just very... it's funny when they're dispassionate. They're just like, oh yeah, I wasn't like passionate about this one idea. I just needed it to make my other idea get published. And then, of course, that ended up defining everything.
Right. And I think it's like, you know, I know it's completely different, but there's like other shows that we can talk about later on down the line that they have the same kind of like, they like you said, a concept. And in this case, like there's one that he did. I don't know if you heard of this one, Captain Tsubasa, which is a big one too. And he like kind of like he was really into like soccer and European soccer. So it's kind of like, in a way, it's like that inspiration took away and then just like took off in a way. Wait, so it was kind of like interesting.
Wait, he did Captain Tsubasa or whatever?
No, there's another author that he... Oh. Sorry, I know it was a little tangent, but it was like the same author that created Captain Tsubasa, kind of just like he had this, like, an idea for a show. I was just kind of like...
Yeah, man, it's fair. It's on topic. No worries.
Yeah,
exactly. That's the whole fun thing. It's like how Toriyama, the legend of Toriyama is that Toriyama made Goku go Super Saiyan because he just didn't want to fill in Goku's black hair anymore. I think that's like actually kind of bullshit. It might not be true, but again, it's just the funny things of like, oh yeah, this whole iconic thing was just something he did out of convenience for his job.
Well, it's like fun. I kind of find it interesting. I know we'll get to the show, but yep. About Toriyama is the fact that what I read just recently is the fact that he was like, after Dragon Ball Z was done, he didn't want to write it anymore. He was like, I'm done. I'm good. It's golden. I like the way it is. And then they came out with Dragon Ball Evolutions.
Yeah, and then he had to make that movie. He had to make, what is it, Battle of the Gods? Because he's like, yeah, that can't be the last fucking thing that exists out of Dragon Ball.
He was like so tilted and pissed off that he was just like, I have to make another thing because it can't be the end like this.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kurumada, he quickly came up with the ideas for the Five Saints. And to make the story more interesting, he had Ikki start off as a villain. So Ikki was always going to be one of the core five, but he was just like, yeah, I need a story hook. So he's going to be a villain for this little portion, which, hey, that's smart, because that was a hook that worked for me when we talk about these episodes. So his constellation choices, they also came out of practicality, as despite there being 88 constellations, not all of them were suited for characters. So again, he just picked the easiest ones, because I found this great little interview and he's like, well, some of the constellations, we can't just do like a Big Dipper character. That's not going to be a saint. So we're just going to do the cool constellations. And when I run out of cool constellations, we'll go from there. So again, you know, he's a dude trying to write a weekly manga. He's obviously passionate about his story, but other things come out of practicality. Sometimes you just have to make a choice. So Saint Seiya, it would debut in Shonen Jump in December 1985. It initially ran for 28 volumes across 5 years, with its anime adaptation running from 1986 to 1989. Like you said, so that's an interesting point to make. The Saint Seiya adaptation does not cover the final arc of the manga. It is, I think, like the last 30 episodes or so are basically original, you were telling me?
Yeah, so like so you have the Sanctuary arc, which is the first arc, which is practically you go from, you know, 1 to 73 or 74. Don't quote me on it. I don't remember. It's been a while that I saw the whole show because it was on Netflix at one point.
Yeah, and now it's taken off. I had to find this on Crunchyroll. Fuck.
Yeah, it's on Crunchyroll now because Crunchyroll has the rights for it now. It's also both in English and Japanese. But the Falling arc, which is the Asgard arc, it's just a anime new to it. There's nothing to the manga because it's like the pretty much the arcs that are on the manga itself is the Sanctuary, the Poseidon, which is after the Asgard, and Hades, which came out in 2002, and it has like multiple parts to it. And there's other like different reincarnations of the show down the line, which is like you have like Sayori and Seiya's daughter, which is a saint at one of them. I don't remember the title of it. I saw a little bit of it and I was like, I don't like this. It's a little different. But they have like a female as me being the main character. So yeah.
Yeah, there's been a lot of Saint Seiya adaptations. Like we would be here all day if I listed it. Plus there's like adaptations that were not by Kuramata. There's even a spinoff running right now that's not by Kuramata. It's by a different author. I don't think it's gained as much traction, but it does exist if y'all just look up Saint Seiya and type in like most recent on like Baka or something. But yeah, there's a ton of Saint Seiya material. Anyways, the manga has sold over 50 million copies, making it one of the most successful of all time. Like I said, the final manga arc wouldn't be adapted until 2002 with the Saint Seiya Hades saga, which finally ended in 2008. That's 31 episodes total. I think you're already touching on it. I'm just going through my notes. There's also been a sequel series a la Dragon Ball GT, as well as a CGI reboot on Netflix. I heard the CGI reboot is terrible, but apparently it's still getting a third season, so good for them.
Well, the thing is, like, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but yeah, I was reading the synopsis of that live at the Netflix one, and I was like, why? You switch four of the main characters' names, and that one has a controversy because Shun, which is Iki's younger brother on the show, on the original show, they made him a female character. Okay, I am not against female characters being main characters, but at the same time, it's kind of like it takes away from the original show. You know what I'm saying? So it's kind of like, go ahead.
I've seen some other criticism too, where it's just like, why did you already make the most effeminate of the saints the female? Couldn't you have like done something interesting and made like Shiryu the girl? At least, you know, just do something more interesting than be like, okay, this is already the quote unquote girliest of the saints, so we're just going to make them a girl. It's like, no, maybe you could have. Maybe Iki the girl just done something more interesting than
right
who they even chose. You know what I mean?
Because I think like Shun and Seiya were the only ones that were capped the name, the original names. Like Iki's name changed to Nero, which is the one that they used on the live adaptation. They changed Yoga's last name, and then they changed Shiryu's name, and they changed Sayori's name. So it's kind of like you have four of the main characters of the show changed their names, and Shun became a girl. So it's kind of like, yeah.
Yeah, that's fucking confusing. I'll say that. Again, it's not even just like about like gender stuff. It's just like, no, that's just confusing. It makes it hard for us to know what we're doing. Yeah. Anyways, one more thing before we get into the episodes. This is a pretty cool fact I learned. Saint Seiya can also be credited for the explosion in popularity of Yaoi Doujinshi, which for those who don't know, Yaoi is like means gay, and Doujinshi is like fan fiction but for manga, and that's because it's almost entirely male cast made it very easy for queer fans to pair their favorite characters up with one another. So yeah, that's I didn't know that Saint Seiya was the thing that kicked that off, but that's pretty funny.
Well,
good for the queer fans who are like, we're into that. Obviously they needed representation, and again, the fact that Saint Seiya is like male cast of like, you know, very handsome boys, I don't think Kuramata was necessarily thinking about that, but hey, you know, sometimes lightning strikes.
Right.
That was the other thing too. Gundam Wing was also inspired by the beautiful boys of Saint Seiya, because again, I think there were a lot of manga and anime that, you know, this is shonen, which in theory is intended for boys, but again, all these handsome boy characters were appealing to women. And that's what led to like that kind of, it's not quite shoujo, but it's still shown in anime that did appeal to the women, obviously, because it's just the characteristics of those male characters. So that's interesting. Saint Seiya was at the forefront of that too, whether it was intentional or not.
Well, it's like I do have an interesting story. One of my friends in college, she really liked Shiryu, the dragon one, and she wanted to get a tattoo with the dragon because of the show.
Yeah. Again, this is a very popular show, and I'm glad you picked it because, again, this podcast is, of course, very North America focused. Saint Seiya, from what I understand, is much more popular in Latin America. Because, again, it's just how shit worked, what shit was on TV. I'm Canadian, so like Saint Seiya was just like there was a dub of Saint Seiya that I remember on the Canadian youth television channel. Uh-huh. And it was very bad, and it first of all, it wasn't called Saint Seiya, it was called Knights of the Zodiac, which not the worst name, it's still kind of accurate, I guess. But
right, and that's the thing, it's like, because I did not know that it was like and I talked to my friend about this too, I did not know it was called Saint Seiya until it came to the States. So in Brazil, when I was growing up, it was called Cavaleiros do Zodíaco, which is the same thing as the Knights of the Zodiac. So it's the same. It's the same thing. I mean, it's so yeah. You have the same translation in a way.
Interesting. Yeah. And the dub we got was just bad. The theme song was a cover of the song I Ran. So just weird shit, man. Weird shit. It was funny when American/Canadian studios were trying to make anime happen, and obviously they nailed it with Dragon Ball Z. Obviously the original Dragon Ball Z dub is less good than we remember, but it was still good enough to make it insanely successful. But Saint Seiya and other series like One Piece did not get such a good dub. Anyways, I think we're ready to cover the episodes. Let's start with episode one. I'll straight up say, like, it's funny because, again, I told you before I had fallen off this series, and we'll get into reasons why, because I can see why I fell off it. But mm-hmm. episode one, I thought, was actually pretty strong. I think it's, like, a really strong introduction to the concept. So, legend speaks of warriors who will bring hope, the saints. These saints protected the goddess of war, Athena. And we see a tournament between two saints. Guess what? Tournament is going to be a word that comes up a lot, because Saint Seiya did not originate the tournament arc. I think, like I talked to you before on messages, I think it's mostly sports manga that kind of originated that, which makes sense given sports have tournaments. But Saint Seiya for sure is known for its tournament arcs, even more so than like Yu Yu Hakusho. Saint Seiya is like, fuck it, man. We're doing a tournament episode one. So we see a Oh, go on.
No, I was just going to say, it's just like it has one of the worst two characters of the show, one of them being the worst. That's another story for another time, because I just hate Unicorn Guy. Jabu, oh my god, he's so annoying. But anyways, go for it. Sorry.
Oh, so Jabu is the first character we see. I got him confused with Seiya, so in my notes, that's fucked. So that was Jabu we see? Yeah, the one with the unicorn.
That's horn. Jabu, like, he's like kind of like... And you see later on the other episodes, like in season one, he's like kind of like Sayori's like lackey. He's like Sayori this, Sayori that. He's kind of like a kiss ass in a way. So he's Jabu of Unicorn and Baki of Bear. That's like the two characters you see in the first like 3 minutes of the show.
Interesting. Okay, that's funny, because I even got what Baki was wrong. I called Baki a snake or dragon man because I was just trying to guess what his cloth was. But that's funny. That's interesting too, because I did read in that interview with Kurumada that he did consider Jabu to be one of the five, but he's like, oh, I think I prefer Pegasus over Unicorn, and then he downplayed Jabu's presence. So we could have had a Jabu-focused series, man, but we avoided it at the last minute. So yeah, Jabu's getting his butt kicked by a snake dragon man, but he manages to get it together. We then see Seiya having to fight for the Pegasus cloth. And his opponent is a Goliath-looking dude named Cassios. And Seiya, it looks like he's going to get beat down by the big guy, but then he cuts off Cassios' ear with just his hand, and he beats Cassios down with a fury of punches that would make Ken from Fist of the North Star proud. That's the other thing I like about this. Because again, we're talking about like the anime that came out right around the same time of Dragon Ball, maybe just before, maybe slightly after. And so... Fist of the North Star, that was the real shit. back when Saint Seiya first came out. So to see kind of a visual reference in the very first episode that reminded me of Fist of the North Star, I'm like, cool. I'm like seeing the Matrix. I'm seeing like how all this stuff is tied together, you know?
Yeah, I think like the whole scene was just like the way it's done is just, you know, in a way for a 80s show, it's really well done for the first 5 to 10 minutes, because like Cassius is just like, I'm gonna squeeze you, you know, the living shit out of you. And he wants to beat Seiya. And Seiya's like, no, I'm the main guy. I'm the main character. So it's kind of like a big backstory of how Seiya proceeds to his fights. And that's gonna what takes off throughout the series anyways. Yeah, so that's like you see that.
And I didn't think the animation is that bad either. Like, first of all, it's bloody and it's, you know, people are getting impaled and they are getting their ears cut off. Like, man, this is still like, this is hard shit.
Yeah, like the thing is, like, I was trying to read the manga, like the original manga, and it's like, it is bloody. The manga is bloody itself. So in a way, it's, and of course, a 10-year-old Arthur was eating this shit up. I love this stuff. So it's kind of like, that's what took me to the next level with the show.
Yeah, for sure. It's a good start, man. It's a good start. And Seiya, he says this quote, he's like, have you ever felt the power of the universe exist within yourself? Again, I love this shonen dialogue where it's just so uplifting. Flashback to Seiya with his instructor, Marin. Yeah, this is where we get into the awesome female characters. His instructor is a lady, and she's a dope lady. Which, again, for an 80s series, man, even honestly, like, fuck, man, there's plenty of... fuck, man, I was playing Final Fantasy 16, and that game is sexist as shit. It won't give his characters wins at all, even in, like, a 2023 game.
And also so, the thing with Marin, or whatever you want to call her, yeah. She's, like, the silver armor cloth. So she's, like, the eagle, like... kind of like the Blue Eagle, if that makes any sense. So it's kind of like it implies, it's like something that I always thought as a kid too, and also watching the show again, it's like you think that is the Seiya's older sister that he's looking for, because he hasn't found her, because that's what Seiya's motivation is. That's why he goes into this tournament and all this stuff. Sorry, I know it's a little backstory on the story, but just so you have an idea, Jack. So.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, I don't know. And it's funny for me just going into this without it, because I think the show still does a pretty good job at keeping you in the loop. Also, it helps that, like, again, man, this is the 80s. I mean, even a show from the early 2000s would still have to deal with the fact that the viewer may not have seen every episode, or they may have missed stuff too. So, you know, unless you're like buying the, I mean, I don't know what the status of like buying VHS copies of anime was like in the 80s, but shit, man, I guess people just had to catch up in their own ways. So the story had to be somewhat easy to follow.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, Seiya, he's learning how to break a rock with his hand. And Marin tells him, in order to destroy something, you have to break down its atoms. And Seiya takes this seriously. He doesn't just break down the rock. He makes a whole crater. And this is where Seiya debuts his iconic strike. We're going to hear this word a fucking lot. It's called, I know, man, you could die of alcohol poisoning, even just in the 5 episodes we covered of how much you hear this phrase. Pegasus Meteor Punch, which involves tracing the Pegasus constellation. And Cassios goes down and Seiya obtains the Pegasus cloth. And I foolishly thought that would be the end of it. I'd be like, okay, cool. He'll put on the cloth, but nope, we got a bunch more shit we got to do. Before Seiya can leave with the cloth, he has to beat Shina first. And Shina has the power of, I guess, a cobra or a snake. That's what I was picking up.
Yeah, it's like, is the cobra, like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So anyways, there's a whole preamble of Shina beating the shit out of Seiya, and then the box that's carrying the Pegasus cloth finally opens up. This takes like 5 minutes. It's honestly kind of goes on for a bit longer than I would have liked, but hey, that's how it is.
Well, I One thing that I wanted to point out is like I love the fact that Seiya gets the shit beat out of him by China. I love that scene so much. I was like laughing. This is like at 10 o'clock at night. I'm watching the show and I'm like laughing my ass off.
Yeah, it's like,
fair. And then Seiya's like on the ground, and I think it's like she's like, "Why don't you beat me up?" That's what China says to him, and he's like, "You're a woman. I wouldn't touch a girl." Along those lines. It's not quote unquote by it, but I'm like, holy crap. And now you're getting your ass kicked, and then you're trying to be chauvinistic. I'm like, come on, man.
Like, yeah, man. Again, this show does its female characters well. Like that, especially for an 80s series, and even in compared to other stuff even now, man. It does it pretty well. So yeah, he's gaining his ass beat, and then Marin reminds him that his soul and power must align. So Seiya dons the armor, and he's confronted by some grunts, but he takes them down with mock speed punches and even tears China's mask off.
Hey, Jack, before you move forward, there's one other thing that I like about this whole interaction between China, Seiya, and Marin. Marin just like, oh, you take care of it, kind of like gets him to feed it for himself kind of situation.
Oh, so, for sure.
Yeah, I was just laughing that part too, because it's just like, okay, I guess she's just gonna watch, and then he just gets his, like we said, ass just handed to him.
Yeah, 100%. But this was also basically just a glorified test, because China reminds him that the next time they meet, she'll be wearing a cloth of her own, and then we see a row of foes Seiya will soon have to face, which is quite ominous. That's it for episode one. I know I'm kind of skipping over stuff, partly for time, because we still got four episodes to cover. But I thought this was like a strong start, man. Like, I think this like clearly established everything you need to know about the show. Obviously, there will be other concepts that are introduced as the show goes on, but I wasn't bored by this first episode. I thought it was effective.
I think that with the first episode, like, I know there's one part that you kind of skip. It's kind of important. It's important in a way to the story with China and Seiya later on, is the fact that when he fights her, when he like, you know, burns up his Cosmo, he kind of like destroys like the mask, right? So you see her face.
Yeah.
The thing is, like, what becomes is the fact that there's two things that China has to do. Either she falls in love with Seiya, or she has to kill him. So it's kind of like, what is she going to do? So you kind of establish that in the first episode. You don't know much about that until like, you know, halfway through the season, but that's kind of where they're going with that. But it's, so it's a pretty, like you said, it's a very strong episode that established like a lot of like foreshadowing for the future. So just gives a heads up on that one.
I guess for me, I kind of just assumed Seiya would fall in love with Athena, but maybe that doesn't make sense because she's a goddess. So maybe that was my silly thinking.
Yes and no. This kind of like they got shipped a lot when I was a kid too, Sayori and Seiya. But it's kind of like China has feelings for him, but she doesn't want to tell him because otherwise she's kind of like, I'm going to kill you. But in the inside, she's like, I have feelings for you. So it's kind of like a mix bag in a way. So.
Gotcha. Episode 6, Phoenix, the warrior who's come back from hell. I should say that the episode titles are awesome, by the way. Episode 1 was called A New Era of Heroic Legends. So I love this shit. So the great thing about you picking these episodes is that the previously on segments are pretty generous. So it's like I also feel like I kind of know what episode 5 was about. Just because of how the previews work. Because I'm like, oh, should I like write down this stuff? But I just kind of wrote down the quick hits I got from the previously on. So Seiya has just beaten Shiryu, but now he must face the Phoenix. And Shiryu tells Seiya, because Seiya's like in the hospital and he's recovering from his big fight. Shiryu tells Seiya he feels someone has been observing him and the other fighters. And we see Shun, the Andromeda Saint, he's fighting your boy Jabu, the unicorn. And Shun's whole gimmick is his chain whip. And yeah, this is basically just 10 minutes of Jabu getting his ass kicked.
Yeah, I think like it's just like Jabu is so cocky and he's such a a dipshit in a way. I it's like one of my least favorite. He is not going to be my speed wagon for sure. Foreshadowing
yeah.
here.
Yeah, exactly. Shun's gimmick, his chain whip is cool though. Shun's chain whip is fucking awesome. I'll say that.
Yeah, because you have one that's like kind of like, I think is like the circle is the defense, and I think the triangle is the offense. So it kind of works that way.
Yeah. So after this whole beatdown, I did Jabu even like formally lose? I feel like the fight just kind of moved away from that because we get into this whole thing of Shun saying the chains are moving on their own. And it's giving a warning. And the chains say Axia, which points to the gold cloth. And the man behind this, of course, is the Phoenix. And the man behind the Phoenix is Ikki, who is Shun's older brother. And Ikki declares that Shun will be the first person he defeats. And I was quite excited, but you didn't pick episode 7. So I guess we still can talk about episode 6.
Well, I think I was just like, when I was looking, I was like, God damn it. Like, because it stops when Ikki is about to kick Shun's ass. So it pretty much what, like, I kind of remember episode 7 a little bit, but it's kind of like they pretty much, he steals the gold cloth. I know we're talking about 6, but I'll talk about a little bit of 7. He steals the gold cloth because he's working for the, got him
the Black Saints or whatever.
Yeah, so he has the Black Saints with him, and they steal the gold cloth. So like the Pegasus Black Saint, he grabs 2 parts of the armor, and then the Dragon one grabs some parts, and then and so forth. So they just steal the whole thing. So it's kind of like, in a way, that they're trying to get it back. So that's episode 7. Episode 6 is kind of introducing Phoenix as the first antagonistic to the story, but he's not that antagonistic like for very long, but he's kind of like, it shows like that badass entrance. I just love the entrance because it's like slowly opens the cloth, the gold cloth, and then he just comes out slowly. I was just like, I love that. It was just brilliant to me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's what I like. I can see the arc that you've picked for these episodes, because I was like, okay, you know, are you just picking episode 6 because it's the introduction of Phoenix and then we'll move on to something else? But nope, because episode 14 is, I guess, the conclusion of the Phoenix arc, if you will. So I was like, oh shit, so we're not, I don't have to worry about not seeing the Shun fight because we're getting the finale to the Phoenix fight already. And I liked just the way you picked it. The arc worked for me. It tracked, you know, it just kind of, I don't want to say it skipped the filler because I'm sure the fights were awesome in between, right, all that, but it got to the good stuff.
Right. The thing is, like, with the because it's pretty much like you have the Pegasus fighting the Pegasus, and you have the dragon fighting the dragon, and you have the swan fighting the swan, you know, Andromeda fighting Andromeda. So it's kind of like, it's like they're fighting the copies of themselves, but like the Black Saints. So you like from episode 7 to 13, those are the main fights, to be honest with you. You know, of course, Seiya gets his ass kicked by, you know, Black Pegasus, and you know, Shiryu beats the living crap out of the dragon one, but anyways, like, Shiryu already like broke his armor like twice in the show, and there's only been 13 episodes, so it's kind of like, I find that pretty comical in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is where we can talk about the flaws of Saint Seiya, because this is kind of why I don't remember those 80 episodes I watched, which is Saint Seiya is very, very, very battle-focused. There's not a lot of room to breathe, I feel. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's just kind of one fight to the next, which isn't bad. Obviously, there's shows I like, what is it, Jujutsu Kaisen, that is pretty much just fights all the way through. But yeah, Saint Seiya, I think, can get exhausting. And just because it's that 80s style of storytelling where the characters, they're developed, but also, you know, the writing may not be what we expect from modern works. That, yeah, it can just get kind of repetitive, and eventually your brain just starts to see it as all the same.
Like, that's how the show... Yeah, I agree. I mean, I watched the show multiple times before, and it's kind of like, Yeah, there's not like I said, there's not a lot of filler and there's not a lot of room to breathe. But like there are shows like, JJK, Chainsaw Man and so forth, like Vinland Saga even, you have room for you to breathe a little bit, that you can be like, hey, this character is developing a way. He just is always the same, is the same trope in a way with Seiya. Sensei is just the fact that, and that's one thing that even as a 10-year-old I despise, is the fact that Seiya has to be the sole remaining, and we'll talk about it on episode 71 and 72, which is kind of like, so Seiya's kind of like hearing his falling, brothers, going through the steps, and it's kind of like, I'm kind of done with this shit of say being the only one that stands up, you
It's
know?
a very common thing in shonen media too. I mean, is there a Dragon Ball arc where Goku isn't the one to finish the fight? I guess the Cell Saga is the only one I can think of, which ended with Gohan being the one to defeat the final villain. But yeah, even like the Buu Saga kind of shits the bed, where it seems like Gohan's going to be the savior of the universe, and then Toriyama's like, actually, no, Goku's the lead of the series.
Right, that's the thing, the same thing, like the thing that's why I kind of like Sensei is kind of like still in the back of my mind as being like a good show. It's like, kind of like one of the OGs in terms of like shonen. But the things like I like about Yu Yu Hakusho in a way is the fact that Yusuke gets his ass kicked mostly the time, but he's not always the main person standing, because like Hiei has his moments, Kurama has his moments, Kuwabara, and so forth. So that's kind of like, to me, a different perspective. Like Seiya, yeah, like in Sensei, like you see the other fights when you go. I didn't want to go through the Sanctuary arc with the other fights because like they have their moments to shine, but it takes a while for them to get there. So it's kind of like, it should, if it was condensed down to like 50 episodes, the Sanctuary arc still would work, but anyways.
Yeah, for sure. It's like pacing, and again, it's never fun when you realize it's just the lead character's show. Again, not to just turn this into the Jujutsu Kaisen podcast, but I think that's a show. First of all, that show also has like the benefit of hindsight, where it's like, oh yeah, we've had like 30, 40 years of evolution in shonen storytelling that this author can pull from and subvert. So that's his advantage, obviously. But Jujutsu Kaisen has a lead character who isn't even the most powerful character. Yuji has like Sukuna, but then Sukuna also likes to dip and fuck around and be an asshole. So
Yeah,
that's the whole thing. And then we get into spoiler territory, so I can't say more, but you know what I mean? Like, that's a
yeah.
show where its lead character isn't actually the top guy, or at least even if he is going to be the top guy at the end, he's going to go through far greater struggles than even your standard shonen protagonist has gone through.
Yeah, and then that's the thing. It's like that's the one thing, and then there's another thing that I kind of will talk about it too, is the fact that I hate the fact that they had to use the Sagittarius cloth. I'm a Sagittarius myself, so for Saya to be the Sagittarius cloth, that pissed me off. So,
Really? Wouldn't you like to be the lead, though? Wouldn't you like to be like, oh yeah.
that's the thing. It's just like, and then yes and no, but at the same time, I don't want to be like, oh, the power of friendship will win. It's like, yeah, it works for certain shows. But like you see on episode 14, it's like Ikki is beating the shit out of the four saints, and then all of a sudden Sei is the only one that's
Yeah.
standing up, and then Sei is able to beat Ikki. It's like, what sense does this make? There's other shit
So,
that like makes no sense to me that I actually went on Google to look for, and I was like, what the heck is this? This makes no sense. This just blows my mind, but whatever. Go, I'm suspending my belief right now.
so here, here's the thing. I do love Power of Friendship. I do love it. So episode 14, the Phantom Devil has finally been defeated. Spoiler alert, I guess you're looking at the episode titles. You're like, oh, I guess this is the episode where Ikki loses. So Seiya, according to previously on. He's just been brought back from death's door. This is a common thing, even in the episodes we cover. Every previously on is Saint Seiya has just been brought back from the brink of death. Somehow he's alive. In this case, he was charbroiled or something.
And so, he's about... like a little backstory on that one. Yeah. So, I haven't seen an episode in a long time, but this is what happened. So he, like I was telling you earlier, they fought their copies of themselves, but like the Black Knights. So pretty much what happened is, so Black Pegasus got him back before he died. So he defeats, like, Seiya's like defeats the guy, right? And pretty much he hits him with one punch. No, that's not the One Punch Man thing. But he hits him with one punch, and it's kind of like a black mark. And that black mark expands. And then he gets, like, really hot. So he has to take his cloth off. And it's kind of like, you know, so he's unconscious because he's, like, with all this black stuff. And so that's the reason why he's on his, you know, almost dead again.
Yeah, as it is for a shonen protagonist, they get knocked down and then they get back up. So yeah, Hyoga, he had also been defeated by Ikki. He is now joining the fight too. Hyoga's whole thing is ice, and the Saint Squad is now trying to convince Ikki that it's over. So Hyoga uses an ice block technique against Ikki's firepower, and it causes Ikki's specter punch to be reflected. And so I thought this was really cool. And Ikki's like seeing doves, and he has a flashback with the Black Saints. And these Black Saints, they were pretty mean to Ikki. But unfortunately, Ikki does break through the illusion, and he punches Hyoga right through his chest. But instead of a heart, he pulls out the Northern Cross.
So it's not like an illusion. So in a way, it's kind of like so the way the move, Ikki's move works is the fact that they breaks their soul. So it's pretty much like, and it's kind of like he has like, you think it is a, it's not like a flashback, but it's kind of like it is what you have in your mind. It's kind of like a nightmare, but you're awake. So it's kind of like, and then one thing that I found it cool, Yoga's like, no, I took everything away from you that you cared about, and I broke your soul. So, but then Ikki was like, everything has already been taken. Everything that I cared about was taken from me. So it's kind of like, in a way, it's kind of like to break your soul, and then you're just kind of like, you're like a vegetable in a way. But Ikki's just like soulless. That's why I think he's so badass. He's like, sure.
For sure, man. I thought it was really cool, whether I understood the full concept or not. It was still a really cool sequence that I really liked. And it was something beyond these characters punching each other. What does the Northern Cross mean? I didn't understand that shit.
So the Northern Cross is pretty much so on like few episodes before. So like in one thing that the Sensei does it well, it's like episode 2 or 3, they have Yoga's backstory, because they have like Shun's backstory, like later on, Shiryu's backstory, and Yoga's. So Yoga is pretty much, he trained in Russia to become the Swan Saint. So, and his mother, they were like in a ship on a trip, and it kind of like had a kind of like Titanic'd in a way. Yeah. So like her ship is under like some icebergs and stuff like that, and he always went to see her. So she's always in her, like, you know, she always would be that state forever. So that's why he carries the Northern Cross to symbolize his mom. That's why like Ikki makes a comment after he pulls out the cross. It's like, you've always been a mama's boy, and he destroys the cross in a way. So that's the relation of the North Cross.
Okay. So yeah, Ikki, he then takes out the squad with a big fire blast, but then the gold cloth parts come together on their own. And that was interesting. So I guess we can talk about the gold cloth. I thought this episode was going to end with Seiya getting the gold cloth. So how does that work? Like, do the lead characters eventually get their own gold cloths?
Yes. So, like, eventually that will happen. So, like, you know, Seiya, of course, will become the Sagittarius gold cloth, like I said earlier. And so Shiryu will become the gold cloth eventually, because his master used to be the Libra gold cloth. So he will get that cloth. And Yoga will become the gold. He's going to become Aquarius gold cloth because that was his trainer's master. So his master's masters. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. Makes sense.
So Yoga will become the Aquarius gold saint. And I don't remember about Ikki and Shun per se. I don't remember them too, but I think they will eventually. It has been a while that I watched the show, but they will become like, but the main one is Seiya becoming the Sagittarius cloth, and then the Sagittarius cloth comes and helps him multiple times throughout all the different arcs. So, yeah.
Because, like, I was expecting the gold cloth to happen in these episodes that you picked, but it actually didn't, which kind of surprised me. But hey, that's how it worked out. Anyways, with a Pegasus meteor punch, Seiya is able to finally break through Ikki's armor, but somehow Ikki regains his cloth, and that's because, no shit, the Phoenix cloth is able to regenerate. I was just like, oh, it's called the Phoenix, so of course that's what its gimmick is going to be. That makes too much sense. That was awesome. No, I think like that's like legit, like cool of Kuramata. Obviously, it's bringing the abilities of the mythology into the power concepts of his show, which is cool. So yeah, Ikki strikes Seiya, but then Shiryu's shield moves on its own to block it, and then Shun's chain stop Ikki's Phoenix Spectre punch too. You say you don't like Power of Friendship as much. I'm into it, man, and especially for like 80s shonen manga or anime. Like, I'm fine with it not making sense. I get it, because that's just what the era is. I was reading Kinnikuman, and Kinnikuman is 100 times worse when it comes to ass pulls.
No, I think I mind it, but I don't mind it at the same time, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It's that because like I'm sorry that I always bring it up, but like it's always my my blueprint is always like Yu Hakusho, but like Yu Hakusho does the same thing with the Power of Friendship between like Kuwabara and Yusuke. And it's kind of like, it's interesting because like always, they're always mentoring each other. So in a way, I like the way it's done on Yu Hakusho more than I like on Seiya's, because it's kind of like Seiya's, like most of Seiya's fights, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why you fell off from the show, is that Seiya always goes into, you know, like super, super Seiya mode, if that's a saying.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like he gets the huge power up, he gets the, you know, the gold cloth, and he beats the bad guy. And but is the thing is like he never does it on his own, and that drives me absolutely nuts. Like on like in JJK, Chainsaw, so forth, Vinland, Yu Hakusho, like the main character, he's able to put a good fight too. You know, it's like he doesn't need like the power of like Hiei or Kurama on Yu Hakusho or so forth, you know. But like Seiya always needs like Yoga to help him, you know, Shiryu to help him, their cosmos, you know, to power up. That's the one reason why I don't like it as much on Seiya's, because it's kind of like, dude, fight your own battles.
I see where you're coming from. I guess you feel it's overused. It's not like, because I guess for me, I'm only watching these five episodes in the context that I have. So for me, I'm like, okay, that's a great sequence, but maybe I haven't seen it as many times as it happens in the show. You know what I mean?
Because like the thing is, like if you look at the other episodes that we will talk about it on 71 and 72, when Seiya loses all his senses, that scene that he has Yoga and Shiryu, which is like sounds like the same voice actor to me, which would throw me nuts.
Yeah.
And then Shun's voices when he's like, "Oh, you can do it, Seiya! You can do it!" You know.
I hear you. It gets repetitive at a certain point for sure.
Yeah, and but we're talking about like in one arc.
Yeah.
It, you know, that already happens. And we're talking about on a span of four, so episode 14 to 71, that's 57 episodes. Yeah. So it's kind of like we already used that and we're using it again. So
I see what you mean there for sure. And does the Hades arc, I guess, mod spoilers for those listening who don't want to hear, skip
ahead, like, I don't minute. Know because I haven't watched Hades per se. Because I was trying to watch it because, like, back in when I was in college was, like, early 2000s. So, like, you don't have, like, a lot of the tools, I guess, to watch it. I mean, I'll probably watch it because I have Tubi and Tubi TV. I don't know if you guys have it in Canada, but they have all, like, the Hades, the Lost Canvas. They have all those stuff. So it's kind of like. I'll probably watch it eventually, but I'm trying to breathe a little bit on stuff that's coming out right now. So we'll see.
Yeah, bro. Fuck. I just found out that Sandland debuted with 7 episodes today. I was just like, oh shit, they're dropping all 7 and they're all dubbed too. I'm like, oh fuck, I guess we're covering that on the podcast as well. especially because, you know, RIP Toriyama. So there you go, dear listener. That's what we're covering next. But yeah. There's so much fucking shit. Not that shit. It's all good. It's good shit. But man, there's a lot of anime. But that's interesting. Maybe I'll jump ahead and just watch the Hades arc and tell you how I feel if I have the time for it.
Right.
Who knows? Maybe Seiya does get it together at the end. I'm sure he uses the power of friendship because that's just. I think I understand where you're coming from that it's repetitive and that's a fair criticism because we all get bored when it's the same shit every time in an arc. But I think you can also argue it's just a theme that Kurumada likes, and that's the theme that's part of his story. So that would be the defense I make for it. But I also understand your critique. So anyways, the unstoppable power of friendship has awakened deep inside Seiya, and then Hyoga's diamond dust and Seiya's meteor punch combine to finally take down Iki. And then Iki tells Seiya he'd never understand the hell he went through. So I guess that...
Now, one thing that I wanted to say, which made me laugh so hard on this episode, and an episode like 71 too, is like the one insult that the English voice actors love to use on the show is imbecile. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. I didn't pay attention, but yeah, I guess that's their.
No, they're like Iki calls Seiya imbecile like at least 5 times on the episode. It's comical to me. And it's like, you imbecile, you're never going to defeat me. And I'm like, dude, it's like, okay. And then Seiya's like, but Iki, and then like, Seiya's stupid. Let's just point that out. Seiya's dumb.
He's a shonen protagonist. They're all kind of idiots.
Right. But at the same time, I'm like, he's turning to a bad guy. Like on the following episode that we'll talk about. It's like, he's turning into a bad guy. Go. Just go. Go save her. But he just stands there like a dumbass. But whatever. But
and I guess what Iki tells Seiya, that's foreshadowing for what happens next, I suppose, when he says he'll never understand the hell he went through.
Right. The next episode pretty much is like episode 15 and is kind of like they talk about what hell Iki went through on the Queen Death Island, which is where he trained to be the Phoenix. Because and then Iki's backstory is on that episode too. So if you want to know what happened, that episode is pretty much tells you what truly happened. Because he pretty much fell in love with a girl that was like the dad's daughter, that was the trainer's daughter, and he, in a fit of rage, he killed her, and then Iki just lost all compassion and he beat the shit out of the guy.
Yeah,
pretty much what happens on that episode.
Let's get into our two-parter that closes out this podcast. Fire Clock Goes Out, Who is Pope? Episode 71. So, the deadly battle of Sanctuary is finally drawing to a close. Shun has just won a battle at the cost of his life. I'm sure he'll be fine. Meanwhile, Marin's cosmos has re-sparked Seiya's life. Seiya's senses have faded. This is going to be a common thing, is fucking fading senses. And he's stuck in a field of roses. Flashback to a young Marin training Seiya. that was cute, I thought. And I guess, are they actually related, or does he just call her sister because it's a sisterly relationship?
Like I said, like early in the episode, is like he's looking for his sister. So there is theories that Marin might be his missing sister, because if you think about it on the episode, because I was just, it was like the memories were drawing back on my head too when I was watching it, because on that part that he's like fainted on the stairs, she like puts the mask on him so he can breathe better. Why that, I don't know why that's the case, but okay. And then, but you don't see her face. You don't truly see her face. So there's always like that idea that she might be his sister.
Gotcha. So yeah, Marin is carrying Saya, but she also collapses and she puts that mask on him. And then using the Pegasus meteor punch, Saya obliterates the demon roses and gives himself an opening to the Pope's chambers. And then Shina, she comes back. So again, that's, you know, it's all tying back. All the things we've established are coming back. Shina offers to take care of Marin as Saya makes his big confrontation. So Saya confronts the Pope, and even his meteor punch does nothing to the Pope, and the Pope simply cries and walks away. And Saya is shocked at how remorseful the supposedly evil man is. And the Pope tells Saya to take a shield to point in the direction of the arrow that's in Athena, because I guess that's the whole point of this arc, that Athena's has an arrow in her that's causing her to die, and that Saya and the Saints have to confront the Pope to finally save her. That's correct, right?
So, like, the whole arc pretty much is like, so each saint, gold saint, has a fire. So every time that they go to each houses, they go to all the zodiac. So Aries to Pisces, and the fire symbolizes each hour they have. And in the beginning of the, she goes to the sanctuary, she gets that golden arrow on her. So if the time extinguishes, she's dead. So that's pretty much, yeah, you pretty much got the gist of it.
So we have this big Pope confrontation. What was it? Marin reveals her journey to discovering the Pope's identity, and she says she found the body of the Pope who lay dead for over 10 years. So wait, this guy isn't actually the real Pope?
Yeah, so technically speaking, and they will talk, I think there is a backstory to it later. So they're practically twin brothers. I don't remember exactly their names, but they're twin brothers. So pretty much like, on the episode too, you see that he gets the Gemini cloth. So one represents the evil brother, and the one represents the good brother. So the Pope that is, when Saya is on the first episode, he pretty much goes into, you know, he sees like, oh, you earned the bronze cloth of Pegasus. So that's the good brother. Mm-hmm. And then the older brother took his place, the twin brother, evil twin brother, took his place. So pretty much he killed his younger twin brother. I know it's confusing. I know.
So I'm just asking a question. So like, but wait, it seems like they're inhabiting the same body. So how does that work?
So pretty much he has like dual personalities in a way, so which symbolizes Gemini. That's pretty much but one. It's kind of like, because you see on the episode too. Sorry, I didn't answer the question earlier, but pretty much the, because you see like a part of the mask is crying because that's the remorseful part of him. So he has like dual personality.
All right then. So yeah, the Pope's armor, like you said, is revealed to be that of the Gemini, and he is able to send Saya to another dimension. I thought the whole other dimension thing would play a bigger role, but it seems these characters can quickly leave those dimensions, so it's not that big of a deal. It's like, oh, sweet.
It doesn't play a big part on this episode, but it plays earlier on the arc itself, because when they go through the Gemini house, which is controlled by Saga, which is Gemini's gold saint, that's his name. It's pretty much, he controls it from the Pope, where the Pope is sitting. So they, like, they are sent to different dimensions throughout the arc.
Okay. Totally not confusing at all, but I'm sure it makes more sense if you have the full context.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah.
No worries. Episode 72, Don't Waste Your Friend's Death, But Go, Seiya. The Pope begins removing Seiya's senses because, again, Seiya can't just... Fuck, man. He's always losing his senses. God damn, man. They love doing that. They love doing it. It's like they can't even wait two episodes for Seiya to lose his fucking senses.
It's not just Seiya, because the previous episodes when... So Yoga dies fighting Aquarius.
Yeah.
So he loses his senses too at some point, I think. Because that's like you have to reach your seventh sense, which is kind of like you're going Super Saiyan in a way, in comparison. And Shun dies, fighting Aphrodite, he reaches his seventh sense. So, like, in order for you to reach those senses, you have to lose all your senses. If that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah, this is dope. Iki's back, man. It all ties together with what you've been doing here, with this little arc you've been building out of these five episodes. So, Iki is back, and he's told to go to the Pope's chamber. And Iki's regeneration ability will be a massive boon to defeating the Pope. Seiya, he's starting to regain some strength, and he starts holding his own. But then the righteous face starts crying, which freaks the Pope out. And then I guess Seiya, so sorry, I think, to be honest, I might have not been paying attention. How did Seiya go into where the shield is? Because he's fighting the Pope, and then he kind of transports to where he has to go to get the shield.
I'm still trying to figure out that myself, to be honest with you.
It just kind of happens.
No, it's kind of like he is the power of friendship, man. The power of friendship.
Okay.
Because it's kind of like I was telling you earlier, he kind of like listens to the voices of Yoga and Shiryu and Shun. So that's what is guiding him in a way. Because he can see, he can't talk, he can taste, but he's still talking. He still has a monologue, which drove me nuts. I was like, what the fuck is going on? And then he... supposed to be crawling because you're not supposed to be able to walk because you lost your touch senses. How can you throw your punch? That part drove me nuts because it made no sense to me. I know I'm supposed to believe it, but I was just like, you lost all your senses and you're still talking. I don't know. And still walking.
Yeah. Fair enough, man. There we go. Iki, he finally arrives and drags the fight out with his regeneration abilities. So again, we have like a sequence where the Pope sends Iki to another dimension, but then he comes back and he's like, yo, hey, bitch, my cloth regenerates. So, I can just do this all day, buddy. So that's the guy who you want to be the distraction for sure. You want Iki to be the guy holding it out with the big dog since he can just keep getting back up. And then, yeah, Seiya, despite being weakened, he manages to grab the shield, and he doesn't quite remove the arrow from Athena in this episode. It's kind of ambiguous, but clearly it's about to happen. Because it's just like, they kind of play around with it. They're like, oh shit, he lifted up the shield, but then he fell. Is it actually going to land? Is the light from the shield actually going to land on the arrow? And the episode ends ambiguously.
He does remove it. So it doesn't like I'm don't want to start to point it out, but
yeah,
it's he grabs the shield, he gets punched on the stomach, so it kind of like does enough to hit it, so it like the arrow completely like disappears, and then the way the episode ends is pretty much like she like Sayori's like eyes open. And she's like, and then you see that a rainbow covering her. So she is alive, of course.
But, yeah. For sure. It's just, it happens at the very last minute because, of course, they want to get you on the edge of your seat, of course. Yeah, shit. I guess that's the end of the five episodes we've covered. Let's get into our favorite segment then. Cue the music.
Oh,
You know, my speedwagon is going to be Ikki. I got to go with my heart. And to be fair, you picked some pretty Ikki-focused episodes. But what can I say? Correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe there's other characters that fit this better, but I feel from what I've seen, Ikki is kind of the Vegeta, if you will, of the Saints. Is that right?
Yeah, he's like kind of like your Hiei, your Vegeta, your, the bad boy going good.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't love that type of character for sure? I thought it might have been Shiryu, but I guess Shiryu is pretty much good the whole way through. Maybe Shiryu is the Zoro or the Krillin. A little bit
of a dick in the beginning, but it's kind of like after they have, on episode 5, which you didn't see, which is a fight between Pegasus and Dragon, Shiryu is kind of like a dick towards Seiya. But then when he saves his life, it becomes best friends, but yeah, I would say like my speedwagon. Yeah. Definitely Jabu unicorn. definitely. No, he is like the worst character. I don't care about him. Never did. As a kid, never did. Still don't. He's kind of like a little bitch, because even on the episode 6 that we kind of like went through it, he's kind of like, oh, Sayori, I'll do this for you. And it's like, shut up. Nobody cares. I have two. Is that okay if I pick two?
Go for it, man. There's no real rules to this.
So I would say China is one of the characters I would pick as a speedwagon, because she is like, she's a badass. The way she beats the crap out of Seiya, and then she's vowed to destroy Seiya's life. I love that. And of course, Ikki would be my other one, even though he's supposed to be one of the main 5 saints. And the thing is, like, the way I picked this episode, I did not do this on purpose, and it kind of worked out this way, is the fact that I consider this to be the Ikki, like, redemption arc, in a way. Because he starts on episode 6 as being the bad guy, and on episode 72 he's like with the guys, fighting with them. So Ikki would be my other one. So
I hear you, man. Ikki's a cool dude, man. What can I say? And I guess, the Phoenix ability to regenerate, that's a pretty awesome ability, and also just it makes more sense than other powers per se, because you're like, oh yeah, Phoenix, of course, it resurrects, rises from the ashes. So I dug that. There we go. Final thoughts on Saint Seiya. I'll go. First of all, shout out to your picks. I think those were really strong picks that did showcase the series the best, or at least I was satisfied by how you did them, Arthur. It made me appreciate the series, because again, I think, like I said earlier, the issue with Saint Seiya is just it's so battle focused, it can almost be exhausting. I understand that's the appeal of the series. Also, it's obviously from an earlier era, so the storytelling is of its time. And, like you said, Yu Yu Hakusho has done it better since. Jujutsu Kaisen has done it better since. Obviously, those authors have the luxury of, first of all, they were probably fans of Saint Seiya themselves or other works like Bleach that were inspired by Seiya. But, it's dated. But as an artifact, as a part of the history of shonen manga and anime, I was happy with it. I might even want to watch the Hades saga, honestly, because maybe that's probably a stronger saga, given that it's the end of where the manga goes. And I'm sure even if I haven't watched the other episodes, I'd be fine, because let's be real, these characters are not the deepest, and that's fine. That's obviously part of the appeal. But yeah, I found these 5 episodes to be a strong showcase for Saint Seiya. I get it. I still have my reservations because, there's only so much free time we have in this world that I don't necessarily want to watch 120 episodes of this. But I certainly appreciate the historical context. And what I forgot to say this, when it comes to golden transformations, Saint Seiya beat DBZ by like 4 months. So it wasn't like it beat it by years, but it beat it by a couple of months when it came to the gold transformation.
Yeah, I think it is a show that is it's worth watching for what it's for and what is done. I think, like you said, I do agree with a lot of things. Like, it is very battle focused. The characters don't develop as much. It's always like, you know, beat bad guy and you defeat the, you know, whoever he's fighting. And I think, and Sayori gets better. Like, on the first arc, she's not as strong. She doesn't embrace her Athena kind of situation. But like on the Asgard, which is the second arc, and the Poseidon, is actually doing shit to save the world. So it's kind of like she even improves a little bit. But Seiya always gets his ass kicked. So, and it's this Seiya show, like I said, you know, in previous things that I talked about, but it's kind of like, but it is what it is in a way. So.
Yeah, absolutely, man. There we go. So that's Saint Seiya for you. Arthur, where can we find you if you want to be found or you want to be a private citizen, maybe?
You can find me. I do have my own anime podcast. It's called Anime Lost Translation. We talk about, you know, when shows comes to from the original media to coming to the anime screen. I'm changing the stuff up over there. I don't remember my numbers on the Instagram, which is bizarre. It's a second account, long story. but yeah, that's pretty much the two places you can find me. I do have a Twitter with Anime Lost Translation, Anime LT Pod on Twitter or X, whatever you want to fucking call that shit now. And then that's pretty much where you can find me.
Awesome. As always, you can find me at OnlyRealJackM on Twitter. Jack is Jack on Instagram. At is this anime pod on Instagram. We're not active on Twitter anymore ever since the Twitter to Insta functionality was taken away by Elon. So fuck you. But if you still want to give a follow to a dead account, you can find it at is this anime pod on Twitter. Yeah, Arthur, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for asking to be on this. Obviously, dear listener, I'm totally welcome to have people on. Because again, I just like making friends, man. I need people to talk to, talk about anime with. And, you know, even when you asked me to do this, we just went into like an hour long conversation just about our favorite shonen shit. So that's the whole thing, you know? Anime is cool, man. We all love anime. We all have our things, and I'm always welcome to doing different things too. That's the thing. Cause you know, I was obviously a fan of Yu Yu Hakusho, but it was when you brought up Saint Seiya, I'm like, yeah, man, that's something we've been missing out on. And so I'm glad we've covered it on the podcast. Cause this is a very important series. Whether I have the same affection for it as other things, that's besides the point, because what I like about this podcast is we can talk about things we don't necessarily love, but we can still educate ourselves because, you know, we can be historians about this stuff because there is like such a wonderful history. And again, I didn't even know anything about Rinni Kakero, which it turns out is perhaps even more important than Saint Seiya in some ways, given how much Toriyama loved it. Like, shit, man, we're all learning things today.
So, well, thanks for having me, Jack. I mean, that was the one thing that I was looking really forward to. Throughout this past week or so.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much. All right. Thank you, dear listener, for listening. I guess you know what we're covering soon, unless something happens. We're definitely going to be covering Sandland because that literally just dropped. So take it easy, folks, and enjoy watching anime.